From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the long road ahead for Syria, violence in Mexico reaches the classroom, and the scent of lemongrass in Asia. Governments have fallen in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, but one of the most important Arab rulers has so far resisted the pressures of the Arab Spring. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad faces protests from inside and outside his country. Still, he continues a relentless and bloody crackdown on his opponents. The Syrian ruler's survival is forcing people to reevaluate the direction of their uprising. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
It's time for a reassessment of the Arab Spring, the movement that's toppled three Arab regimes, says Vali Nasser, a former U.S. government advisor.
The reason we have to rethink our approach to the Arab Spring in light of what is happening in Syria, we have to realize that the path to democracy is not going to be straight and quick.
In Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, the path is just beginning. The outcome in Syria is more uncertain, he says.
The path to something better in Syria may in the short run have to go through a messy conflict that we have to be prepared for and have to know how to manage.
Assad's exit is far from clear. The longer he stays in power, the more violent the country becomes, according to diplomats in Damascus. Reports that the Obama administration is working with Turkey on ways to manage the fallout from a civil war in Syria match fears in the region, says Tarek Massoud with the Kennedy School at Harvard.
There are a lot more important players who are invested in the stability of the Syrian regime than were invested in the stability of the Libyan one.
Iran has sent cash to shore up the Syrian economy. In neighboring Lebanon, new popular songs praise Syria's president. Here, Hezbollah, the Shiite Muslim group, backs him too. The head of Lebanon's Maronite Christian Church has warned that the end of the Syrian regime threatens Christians across the Middle East. But Arab leaders, led by Saudi Arabia, have begun to abandon Assad, challenging Syrian claims the uprising is led by terrorist groups.
Nobody believed that argument. The intelligence gave a very clear picture of what is taking place in Syria.
That's Jamal Khashoggi, a prominent Saudi journalist who listened in on a conversation with the Syrian president.
I heard a telephone conversation between a Saudi official and Bashar al-Assad, and the official was just laughing. He just didn't believe it. It's unconvincing.
The Saudi king recalled the ambassador to Syria. The Saudi-backed satellite channel Al Arabiya has stepped up coverage, featuring videos showing gruesome government violence against demonstrators. The Saudi leadership has given up on Assad, says Khashoggi.
I think they have.
Do you expect them to take more measures?
That will be very difficult. Right now, the Syrian army is occupying the Syrian cities. How to intervene locally?
There's no Saudi backing for military intervention, he says, which raises the question, is Syria's Arab Spring about to enter an even more violent season? Armed attacks against the army are growing. Demonstrations remain largely peaceful for now, says Peter Harling with the International Crisis Group in Damascus.
They've been preparing themselves for confrontation if there is no alternative, but showing considerable restraint.
More on the street now ask, is peaceful protest the way to go?
This is also the expression of a great degree of frustration.
Frustration over the cost. With almost 3,000 dead, something has to give, says Bassam Haddad, an academic and author of a book on Syria's political economy.
We are talking about a death rate of 100 people per week. For this to continue for 14, 18, and 20 weeks is just unfathomable.
Syria is far more complex than Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, a multi-ethnic society, including a Christian community that dates back to the first century. These communities have deep fears as well as demands, which raises complicated questions, says Josh Landis, an authority on Syria.
And so it's not a simple matter of the good people against the bad dictator. which is the way we've tried to paint all of these stories.
The Syrian story is one of a minority sect that has ruled over a majority Sunni Muslim population for 40 years, carefully granting favors to other minorities and ethnic groups in exchange for loyalty, says Landis.
I think they're going to fight to the bitter end, and this is going to be bloody. And so it'll have aspects of ethnic and religious war, as well as the democracy lovers against the tyrants.
So far, the Arab revolts have lasted a few weeks to a few months. Syria is a game changer as the protests continue with prospects of more violence to come. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Beirut.
Coming up, violence in Mexico reaches the classroom and the scent of lemongrass in Asia. In the Mexican coastal city of Acapulco, teachers are out on strike. But it's not because of wages or working conditions or pensions. They're refusing to work because of crime. The teachers say they're being extorted, kidnapped, and intimidated by local gangs, and they're refusing to return to their classrooms until the government does something to protect them. Acapulco has been terrorized over the past 2 years by drug cartels fighting for control of the once popular tourist resort. Here is NPR's Jason Bobian.
Public schools across most of Mexico resumed in late August, but in Acapulco, more than 100 schools have been shut for more than a month. Last week, about 7,000 teachers marched up the main tourist strip in Acapulco, past the store selling Senor Frog's T-shirts and quart-sized margaritas. Their banners demanded security and peace. As Mexico's drug war drags on and the government cracks down on narcotics trafficking, there's been a spike across the country in kidnapping, car theft, and extortion. Teachers refused to reopen schools in Acapulco after there were several anonymous demands for educators to hand over half their salaries to criminal gangs by October 1st or be killed. In the middle of what should be a school day, hundreds of teachers have gathered at a school near the center of Acapulco, waiting for instructions from their union leaders.
Estamos exigiendo seguridad a los tres niveles de gobierno.
A primary school teacher, who for security reasons only wants to give her first name, Betty, says we are being attacked, extorted, and kidnapped with impunity. Manuel Lozano Hernandez says the teachers are publicly fighting a problem that's plaguing taxi drivers, shopkeepers, restaurant owners, and even street vendors in Acapulco.
Yo creo que la lucha que están haciendo los maestros.
I believe that this fight that the teachers are making is a defining moment. Because having been a teacher for 32 years, I'm convinced that teachers have their finger on the pulse of what's happening in every house, every neighborhood, every street, and every family. Thus, this issue is very important.
Longtime residents of Acapulco say crime in what used to be one of Mexico's leading tourist resorts is out of control. There have been shootouts by heavily armed gunmen in front of beach hotels. Several women were decapitated this year at the start of the Semana Santa holiday, Mexico's big spring break. As in many other drug-plagued Mexican cities, federal police and soldiers in ski masks patrol the streets in armored convoys. One local college student says the recent crime wave is like a psychosis that's gripped Acapulco. A waiter says violent crime is crushing the economy. And now it's delayed the start of classes at many schools across the city by more than a month.
Claro, por supuesto que afecta muchísimo, ¿no?
Mercedes Martinez Calvo, the director of education for the city of Acapulco, says the walkout by the teachers clearly has had a huge negative effect on students. She says schools, and particularly teachers, are going to have to come up with a plan of how to make up all of the instruction time that's been lost. Martinez says this might mean longer school days or classes on weekends. Parents recognize the severity of the current crime problem and sympathize with the teachers, Martinez says, but she adds that there's growing public frustration with the strike. She says each day, more and more schools are opening across Acapulco. Jason Bobien, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Any walk through the concrete jungle of a Southeast Asian city would present a smorgasbord of smells. Some are enticing, others downright rank. Among the urban odorama, one pungent fragrance stands out: lemongrass. NPR's Anthony Kuhn gives us a whiff of the herb that's essential to the cuisines of Southeast Asia.
Tucked away beside the bustle of Bangkok's Convent Road is Knot, a family-run restaurant and Thai cooking school. Thanapon Makawat, the founder's son, welcomes us.
Now we are in herbs garden. We have more than 50 herbs. We have like lemongrass, basil, cumin leaf, pandanus, the main ingredient that we use in Thai food.
Across from the lemongrass is a row of its close relative, citronella. It's used to make citrus-scented candles and a natural mosquito repellent. Thanapon removes the tough outer layers of a stalk of lemongrass, revealing its pink insides and unleashing an incredible smell. If you haven't experienced the smell yourself, perhaps the best way to describe it is... The fragrance is intense and ornate, like a filigreed Eve curlicuing from the roof of a Thai Buddhist temple. In Thai dishes, Thanapon says, lemongrass lifts the weight of meat and oil. It replaces the weight with an herbal pungency and an exquisite lightness.
Most of the Thai dish we use the lemongrass is very important. Like sometimes when you have like the curry, because the curry is oily, and the lemongrass, it can help you digest and can help the blood circulation. It's very healthy.
Let the lemongrass overwhelm your senses. Eat a pile of the stuff raw, in the form of a Thai lemongrass salad. Thanapon cuts several lemongrass stalks into little discs. Bits of dried shrimp, squid, and peanuts add crunch. Tiny chili peppers provide punch far above their weight. Finally, Thanapon pours on a dressing of lime juice, fish sauce, and sugar. He tosses the salad and serves it wrapped in jade green betel leaves. Lemongrass grows wild and in gardens throughout much of Southeast Asia. Thanapon's mother, Lokananat, explains that when many Thai people go to their gardens to pick some herbs for dinner, lemongrass is often what they come back with.
When you were growing up, did you have lemongrass growing near your home?
Oh, yes, sure. Because lemongrass is the most essential ingredient in every dish of our curry. From 10 dishes, you may have about 8 dishes that have to use this essential ingredient, lemongrass.
Lemongrass is also a key ingredient in the cuisine of Indonesia. In spicy rendang beef or chicken, scented rice, or salsa-like sambal condiments. At the Jakarta Bed and Breakfast, owner and cooking school teacher Clara Sitompul prepares a lemongrass-flavored beef soup. She cuts the beef into cubes. Then, to bring the flavor out of the lemongrass, Sitompul uses something no Indonesian kitchen should be without. It's a flat mortar and pestle called a chobek, which is used to grind up spices. Then the flavorings are stir-fried.
And then you must cook this onion, ginger, and the lemongrass.
Sitompul boils the beef and finishes the soup by adding a plate of celery, caramelized onions, tomato, black pepper, coriander, and lemon peel. She says the best way to describe the taste of lemongrass is by its effect. Appetizing, almost Pavlovian.
When you cook this lemongrass, you must be hungry if you smell it, of course.
Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.